Hi, I'm John Wolfstall, host of We're All Gonna Die Radio here on the Deep State Radio Network. If you're interested in the intersection of cutting-edge technologies, national security, and the things that may just kill us all, then please give our show a listen every Friday. Members of the Deep State Radio Network gain access to exclusive content, access to the DSR Slack and Discord communities, expanded show notes for select episodes, and more. All of this for just $7 a month or $70 a year. As a thanks for listening, I'm offering a 25% discount off the regular membership price. Please visit thedsrnetwork.com/buy and enter code cyber. That's thedsrnetwork.com/BUY and code cyber. Thank you, and thanks for listening.
Nine, 12, 10, 28, 2, 23.
This is Deep State Radio, coming to you direct from our super secret studio in the third sub-basement of the Ministry of Snark in Washington, D.C., and from other undisclosed locations across America and around the world.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of We're All Gonna Die Radio on the Deep State Radio Network. My name is John Wolfstall. I am your solo host today. Heather Williams is off in the nuclear lands of Los Alamos, New Mexico, and will join us again next week. In our decision-making about a guest today, I worried that having just one guest and one host would make for a slow podcast. But I assure you, you are in for a treat. Our guest today is Joe Cirincione. Joe, hello.
Good morning, John.
Joe is one of my oldest friends in Washington, meaning I've known him a long time. He also happens to be older than me. And for the last 35 to 40 years, Joe has been perhaps the most preeminent nuclear policy analyst and commentator in Washington. He has deep knowledge on nuclear weapons, politics, missile defense, budgets, and basically the deep state. And I was thrilled that he was available today. One, because we always have a good time when Joe and I get together. But at the same time, we talk a lot on We're All Gonna Die Radio about how we're gonna die. Today, I wanted to talk a little bit about the fact that we've lived for a long time under the shadow of nuclear weapons, the risk of nuclear war, and things seem to be changing in people's minds. We tend to talk a lot more today than we did 10 or 20 years ago about nuclear weapons and nuclear war and new technology. And Joe, having worked in Washington for a long time, I think is really well placed to engage in this conversation about how things have changed, where we're headed, maybe how things haven't changed quite as much as people might think. We're going to get into some good history. There'll probably be a couple of movie references. And Joe and I, if there's ever any downtime, Joe and I will talk about the New York Yankees doing better than the Boston Red Sox this year.
The season hasn't even begun yet. So how could you?
Hope springs eternal, as you know. As a Boston fan, you know.
Absolutely.
So, Joe, you've had a lot of roles. You ran the Carnegie Endowment Nonproliferation Program for many years. You were at Center for American Progress. You worked on the Hill as a key staffer at critical times, both at the end of the Cold War. What are you doing today? You're retired. You're working on your garden. You're kibitzing a little bit.
Well, one of the great things about staying around Washington is that all your friends become famous. And so, you know, John, it's a pleasure to be with you as you enter into this new role of not just, you know, making government policy from the White House, but actually just getting to discuss it to the broader public in a way that you haven't been able to do before. So it's great to be here. Me, I am what you might call semi-retired. I don't work anymore. Nobody pays me anymore. I don't go to an office. I don't have a Monday morning anymore. You know that, or a Sunday night worrying about the Monday morning. It's wonderful. I still write. I still talk. I'm on a number of boards advising people. But I'm no longer responsible for a budget. I was the president of Plowshares Fund for 12 years, raising money and giving away millions of dollars. I don't do that anymore. I don't miss any of it. The one thing I do miss is being able to have exchanges with people like you, John, on a more regular basis. And I've been meaning to talk to you about all these things because so much is going on. So many policy choices are before us now. And it's great to be able to do this and have the rest of the world listen in.
All right. So you're broke and you have nothing to do. So we've invited you on. This is great, Joe. It's you're perfect for We're All Gonna Die because, you know, you don't have anything really to live for work-wise. You have life to live for. So look, when did you get to Washington?
I came to Washington in 1981 as a graduate student at Georgetown University.
Okay. So you and Ronald Reagan rolled into town about the same time.
Yes.
Ronald Reagan campaigned against the Soviet Union on rearming America, right? Mourning in America, but also a nuclear buildup. How do you view the world of 1981 and the focus the United States had on nuclear competition with the Soviet Union? And today, where you see palpable, robust effort to ensure that the United States is rearming and building nuclear weapons to compete not only with Russia, but with China. How do you compare those two timelines?
Yeah, well, you know, it's actually very interesting, John. I mean, there's a number of, I haven't done a side by side, but let's work it out right now. Number one, we are at the beginning of a massive nuclear buildup now, spending an estimated $75 billion a year over the next 10 years on building a whole new generation of missiles, bombers, subs, warheads. That's what we're doing in 1980. When I came to town, Reagan was elected on a program of a massive nuclear buildup. There was an organized effort to do that. The Committee on a Present Danger was warning that the Soviets had a chance to launch a devastating first strike against us, and we had to build all new weapon systems. And we did that. So in 1981, 82, 83, when I was in graduate school and then went to work on the Hill in the House Armed Services Committee, that was the big issue, the massive nuclear buildup. We're doing that same buildup, a much more expensive buildup now, but less controversial, less debate about it. So that's comparison number one. Comparison number two, the reaction to that buildup in the 1980s was massive public fear. The publics here in the United States and in Europe thought that Leonid Brezhnev at the Soviet Union and Ronald Reagan here were going to blow up the world because they were deploying new weapons. And you saw massive demonstrations. That was the mass anti-nuclear movement of the 1980s, a million people in Central Park, rock concerts, movies the day after, et cetera.
I was there. I got to tell you, it was a great concert. We had Bruce Springsteen, Jackson Brown. It was totally worth the price of admission.
So you don't see that now. There is no mass movement. There is no mass movement here. You had a surge of arms control efforts that failed in the first half of the Reagan administration, but in the second half, Ronald Reagan became the greatest arms control president in U.S. history, eliminating thousands of nuclear weapons with sweeping agreements. You don't see a push for arms control now. In fact, maybe we can talk about this. I believe arms control is on the edge of extinction. It's going through an extinction event. The structures that we created over the last 50 or 60 years are now either being weakened or outright discarded, and there are no new instruments to take their place. I think the only other thing that I compare it to is the way we're talking about nuclear weapons now is very similar to the way you heard in the beginning of the 1980s, which is not just having the nuclear weapons to deter someone from attacking us, but having nuclear weapons so that we can use them, so that we can use them in battlefield conditions, use them in ones or twos and not hundreds or thousands. And you hear that both by Putin, who talks about using nuclear weapons in Ukraine, and on the Western side about using nuclear weapons against China, for example, should China decide to invade. And where you see the beginning of deployments of these new so-called smaller, that is Hiroshima size, more usable nuclear weapons, all these things are in the mix again.
So nothing could have been a better setup for some of the questions I had for you. I want to get into that because the discussion about using a couple of nuclear weapons is something that truly is different, right? You know, you and I have both taught in Washington at graduate school. We've done it for many years. We have students that have gone on to work in government are now in senior levels of government who have never lived through a world where people were actively talking about using nuclear weapons, right? From the late 1980s, early 1990s until a few years ago, nobody was talking. I mean, we talked about this all the time, that if there was a nuclear weapon used, it would be India or Pakistan because they had a conflict that had nothing to do with us, right? Or,
exactly.
Or Kim Jong-un might collapse and, you know, might use a nuclear weapon just in panic. We now have world leaders who think, or at least talk about nuclear weapons being a useful thing. And we now have American political actors who are trying to get into government, or some of whom are, have been in government, who say, oh yeah, you know, we could use a nuclear weapon here or a nuclear weapon there, and we would control the escalation risk, right? We could destroy a Chinese armada on its way to Taiwan and they would never respond. It's not that this is just reminiscent of the 1980s. It's reminiscent of the 1950s and the 1970s, right? That the United States, because we care more, will drop a couple of nuclear weapons and will show whoever it is that they can't dominate us. And I think that what's different in my mind is then the one consensus was that America had to be engaged in the world, had to lead our allies as part of a global system to oppose communist or Soviet expansion. Today, we have a dominant, maybe not dominant, we have a major strain of American politics that are neo-isolationist.
Yes.
And the idea that we care more about Ukraine than Putin, or we care more about Taiwan than Xi, I think is now a much more debatable proposition. And yet we're still talking about nuclear use. And so it, how do you look at that projection, right? I mean, do you think that there are people in the nuclear advocacy world that are just in denial? Or do you think they really believe that we could use nuclear weapons and control escalation? Or do you think this is their way of deterring?
Yeah. You know, well, these currents have run through the nuclear policy debate since the beginning, since 1945. When we dropped the bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, there were two global reactions to this. One was, these are terrible weapons, we have to get rid of them. And the other was, these are terrible weapons, we got to get some. And those two strains have just intersected, you know, for 75, almost 80 years now in the nuclear world. And sometimes one dominates and sometimes the other does. And, you know, if you've seen the Oppenheimer movie sort of ends in the 1950s, more or less, you know, with the debate over building a hydrogen bomb, the bomb that the weapons we use now, many times more powerful than Hiroshima. But it doesn't get into then what happens in the world after we make those decisions. And what happened in the 1950s is that we went nuclear nuts. We decided that nuclear weapons were the weapons of the future, and everybody had to have them. So the Army started developing systems for small nuclear weapons shot out of howitzers and cannons, short-range rockets. The Navy started developing nuclear weapons to use on ships as depth charges, torpedoes, ship-launched rockets.
I always talk about this as the Ronco phase, right? It'll slice and dice your vegetables. They'll poach your salmon. They're very useful.
Right. Every conceivable mission had a nuclear weapon, a landmine. You know, man, we really did have man-portable nuclear weapons that one or two people could carry to use in battlefield conditions. And so we went from, say, the Oppenheimer debate. We had about 400 nuclear weapons in 1950, 1951. By the time Kennedy becomes president in 1960, there were 20,000. And we're building hundreds of weapons every year. That's what's going on. And it led to the kind of crisis you saw in the Cuban Missile Crisis. And then you get the other reaction. People come close to the nuclear brink and they say, oh, no, this is crazy. We have to back off. And in fact, we do. The 60s saw a surge in arms control measures of all kinds, limited test ban treaty, the nuclear nonproliferation treaty. And then by the 70s, you see Richard Nixon coming in and saying we have to limit the race. This is when each side, U.S. and Soviet Union, had about 30,000 nuclear weapons. We cap them and we start coming down. Ronald Reagan comes in the 80s and he slashes the weapons. And we go down from these global stockpiles of 70,000 weapons down to about, what do we have now, 12,500 globally in the world, about that. The U.S. and Russia having most of them, about 5,000.
I have to go to the
each.
FAS website, Joe, to check the numbers. They're really
well,
good at
yeah, you're the expert now.
Well, I'm not Hans and Matt, but yes, right.
So you've got the numbers at the Federation of American Scientists. And so we enter this period of arms control, and we think, oh, well, here we are. We're back from the nuclear brink. We're all going down. And for the last 30 years, we've been climbing down that nuclear mountain. The slope is down, 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 until now. The reductions have stopped. We've flatlined. And every nuclear weapon state led by the United States, Russia, and China are building more nuclear weapons. And we're going back up. And here we come back to this debate that echoes the 1950s. That is, these nuclear weapons can't just be for deterrence. They actually have military utility. We could use them in a battlefield. We could win a battle. We could win a war by using nuclear weapons. Putin has been saying this now for 2 years in Ukraine. Effectively, by the way, using the threat of using nuclear weapons to deter us. The reason we're not doing more for Ukraine, giving them more kinds of weapons, is in large part, I would say, fear of provoking Putin. And that's not crazy. Biden has done trying to thread the needle now. We now know from the New York Times reports over the last couple of weeks, we came a little closer to using nuclear weapons in the first year of the Ukraine war than we thought. And here we are again where these debates are happening, and you see people coming before the Senate, coming before the House committees, and testifying that not only do we need the big weapons, the ICBMs, the bombers, and the subs, but you know what? We really need to put nuclear weapons back on Navy ships. George H.W. Bush took them off Navy ships in 1991, got rid of all these torpedoes and depth charges that were nuts. The Navy was glad to get rid of them. They were taking up valuable space on conventional warships. So we do not have nuclear weapons on our surface fleet. They're going to be reintroduced because we're starting to make a sea-launched nuclear cruise missile for what? For use in battlefield. What battlefield? Asia, probably. This is the one that's just, we need to have a response in kind, they say, to the Chinese capability, or else we will back down in a crisis. Those are the same kind of arguments you heard in the 50s, you heard them in the 80s when Reagan came in, they're back again.
So I want to talk a little bit, I never disagree with you, but I'll push back a little, Joe. So I do worry about both the expertise that has developed in the arms control community, people who understand how you verify agreements, how you negotiate, what are the elements of a stable relationship with Russia or China. That community is both aging out and being starved of funding, and so it's much smaller and less robust. But I'm actually more optimistic because, as we used to joke, what's bad for the world is good for business in arms control. I mean, the world looks pretty bleak right now, and when you look at the prognosis for an arms race with Russia on nuclear weapons and missiles, an arms race with China on nuclear weapons and missiles and AI and Navy and all these things, it goes on and on and on. There's no end point, right? And eventually, exactly, politicians of all stripes who worry about defense budgets, who worry about not spending money on one area when you could spend it on another military area, say, well, look, where's our off-ramp here? You know, where's our way around this? It was Gerald Smith, former arms controller, who said we're like gorillas on the treadmill, right? How do we get off the treadmill? And one of the ways you get off the treadmill is arms control through negotiations and reaching some sort of agreement that says, look, we're not benefiting here. We're just throwing good money after bad. I mean, there are other ways you get off the treadmill. We got regime change people in the Bush administration that didn't work out so well. You've got, you know, sort of undermining these governments and creating instability. I don't know, that doesn't seem like such a great idea. So I won't say I'm optimistic, but I'm not fatalistic when it comes to the arms control community.
I don't see how you can be optimistic about arms control now.
I said I'm not optimistic. I said I'm not fatalistic.
You're not, okay. Let me be fatalistic.
We are all going to die, Joe.
You're all going to die. Well, let me drag you into my abyss of despair about arms control.
That's what we do here, right?
So I believe that we're heading for the extinction of arms control. We're in an extinction event with arms control, meaning that every year these nuclear treaties, arrangements, security guarantees that we've developed over the last 50, 60 years that have prevented nuclear war are being weakened or outright discarded. And, you know, you have to think, well, when's the last arms control agreement that we developed? Mm-hmm. Well, you know, you have to go back to New START. to 2010.
I heard about that agreement.
You were deeply involved in this on the inside. I was deeply involved on the outside, building up a public campaign because this was resisted. Because remember, this was a big fight over this relatively modest agreement that Barack Obama thought was just going to be a quick fix on the way to a big arms treaty that was going to, you know, slash U.S.-Russian arsenals again, the way Ronald Reagan and H.W. Bush and even W. Bush had done. He was just going to continue this tradition until he ran into the Republican-controlled Senate, and they didn't want to give a Democratic president a political victory in an election year, 2010. The by-election. So they slowed everything down. It took an enormous amount of effort. By the time he finally squeaked it through on the last day of the Senate session in 2010, the Obama staff, you must have heard this, didn't want to hear the words arms control again.
It was not very popular when I said, okay, what do we do next? And like, what do you mean next?
Right. Look how much effort this has cost us. We have all these other things to do. And they just put it on hold, figuring they get back to it. They never got back to it. So we never had except for the Iran deal, which was solving one of the other problems, the spread of these weapons to other countries. Again, an enormous effort, fiercely resisted by who? Bibi Netanyahu, who came and denounced the treaty, tried to whip up domestic opposition, interfered in the domestic politics of his major patron, and almost succeeded in defeating it. Again, you on the inside, me on the outside, we were working to build up support for that. That was in 2014. What's happened since? Well, Trump pulled out of the Iran deal, a massive blow to efforts to stop the spread of the weapons. Putin has suspended participation in New START, a serious blow to the strategic effort. Nothing is happening in either one of those areas. North Korea, meanwhile, has expanded its program. So you're seeing the expansion of nuclear programs on the periphery, North Korea, Iran doesn't have a nuclear weapon, but they're building up the capability to make the fuel for one. And you see the deterioration on the control side. Plus, during the Trump administration, Trump and Putin cooperated. By the way, this is an important theme to watch. When Trump is making decisions to pull out of the INF treaty, the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty that Ronald Reagan negotiated, this is a favor to Putin. This is not standing up to Putin. Putin doesn't want to be in that treaty anymore. He wants the freedom to be able to deploy nuclear weapons in Europe as he sees fits. This treaty was blocking him. He wants to pull out. Trump cooperates. Also conventional forces in Europe. Also open skies. Other treaties. The Vienna documents. All these were just cast aside. And since Biden's come in, bless his heart, he's probably the president who knows more about arms control than any president ever because of his longtime service on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, he hasn't tackled this issue. The exploration, some talk, some statements in some documents, but basically nothing has happened on arms control. So, you know, I think of arms control as like riding a bicycle. If you're not going forward, you're going to fall over. And that's where we are. I think we're looking at the end of arms control as we know it over the next couple of years.
But other than that, Mrs. Lincoln, you know, how was the play? I see you down there in your pit of despair, Joe. I also look back through history and realize that whether it was 1962 and the Cuban Missile Crisis, whether it was the buildup in Europe and then Nixon coming along with Kissinger, you know, a cold warrior and nuclear use advocate, and the quintessential one, eventually figuring out that you could do arms control, right? This was a way of constraining your adversary and putting limits and guardrails around the competition. And so I don't think you're wrong in terms of whether arms control is atrophied. I just continue to think whether it is Trump and his buddy Putin who will try to create some veneer of arms control and create some limits, whether it is a future Democratic administration deciding, look, we can't spend $1 trillion a year on defense. We have to get control of the defense budget, that eventually arms control will be back in the discussion. Whether it's successful or not, I think is a debate because you do need to have a willing partner. Putin is not there, nor, you know, should we be eager to sort of sign new deals with him. But if I could constrain Putin and I was able to get something I think it's worth talking about. But I want to switch to another subject because as much as we love nuclear weapons, There's another theme that I think is really interesting to dig into that historically is repeating itself. And that's on new technology, and particularly on missile defense. Now, you made your fame in working in the House staff, analyzing the performance of the Patriot missile during the first Gulf War in 1991. George H.W. Bush, for those of you that weren't born, came out after Saddam Hussein started lobbing missiles against U.S. positions in Kuwait and Saudi Arabia and Israel. And the Patriot air defense system, which at the time had never been used against ballistic missiles, was fired off against these systems. And George Bush, I think, claimed that it had intercepted 80 out of 85 or 81 out of 89. Some
41 out of 42.
Oh, 41 out of 42. Okay, so lower numbers, but higher performance. And lauded that this was a miracle of American engineering. And you dug into it and realized it didn't intercept effectively a single missile.
Somewhere between 0 and 4.
Right. And I entered Washington in an environment where there was a big debate about whether missile defense was good or bad. A lot of people, including President Nixon, President Carter, President Clinton, thought that missile defense was destabilizing because it would fuel an arms race. Ronald Reagan famously had an opportunity to negotiate complete abolition of nuclear weapons with Gorbachev and refused to do so because he wouldn't give up on his dream of missile defense. But we're in a very different environment today. Missile defense has grown and expanded in regional settings. Israel is benefiting from investments on Iron Dome and Arrow. And there's active discussions about whether Europe should build a missile defense to protect itself against Putin. And missile defense in the 1980s was a con game. It was a bunch of view graphs that defense contractors trotted out to make money. Now it's a reality in the regional and the local setting. It's still a pipe dream when it comes to things like national missile defense or space-based missile defense. But things are changing. And I wonder how you think about those changes, how you view missile defense these days. How should we think about that in the regional context? Does it have a role in the national security discussion?
Okay, first, let me say, I would love to have an effective national missile defense. I mean, who wouldn't? I would also like to have a cure for cancer. I'd like to have an end to racial injustice. I would love to have a really good light beer. But some things are beyond our technological capability. And a national missile defense system is one of those things. And you have to distinguish here between our ability to shoot down short-range rockets, like Scuds, like the kinds of things that Putin is firing at Ukrainian cities, or the Houthis are firing at U.S. ships, and long-range systems. And it's feasible to have a what they call a theater missile defense against short-range weapons because they're traveling relatively slow. They stay within the atmosphere. They're an easier target, basically. We can do this. We can hit a bullet with a bullet, which is amazing. We couldn't do that in the 50s or 60s. We can do it now. But long-range, now you're talking about something that's traveling much faster, that's going out of the atmosphere into space where it can deploy decoys so you can't see the target. You physically can't hit it because you can't track it effectively, can't acquire the target. And then it's coming in, it's re-entering the atmosphere, something, you know, like 5, 6, 7 kilometers a second. It's just very, very fast, and also may have the ability to maneuver, so to thwart your intercept point that you plotted for your interceptor. And all those things make missile defense technically very demanding. And despite billions of dollars that we've spent on this since 1983, when Ronald Reagan gave his March 23rd, oh my goodness, we're near the anniversary.
Tomorrow, Joe, John Pike's party is somewhere.
The March 23rd speech, I was there for that. I was listening to this, where he said that we should, you know, build a shield around America to protect us from missiles the way a roof protects a family from rain.
We would very make nuclear weapons impotent and obsolete.
Right. Very appealing vision. And it stands, you know, this is this traditional conservative vision. We don't protect ourselves with pieces of paper. We protect ourselves with American military might. So we don't need arms control, which is just going to restrict us and the bad guys will sign the treaty and then cheat. No. We need effective missile defenses and an overwhelming offensive force, the combination of a nuclear sword and a missile shield that will protect us. Very appealing. except you can't do it. And we have spent about $350 billion. Some of the best scientists in the world have been working on it. And we still do not have an effective national missile defense system. We have about 45 interceptors that work about half of the time in tests under ideal conditions, but we've never even tested them against a realistic threat that is a long-range missile deploying decoys and jammers and taking evasive maneuvers and somebody attacking your radars, you know. So it just doesn't work. But you can build effective short-range defenses, and Patriot has been improved since we did the study at the Government Operations Committee that exploded its fault. The Army's built a much better system now, as has the Navy, you know, and so you have a number of systems out there that actually can do the job on a theater level, but national missile defense, it remains a hopeless pipe dream.
So if I then, let's say you and I get on a plane again, like we used to do when we go off to some fabulous city in Europe, maybe Berlin or, you know, Italy, and we meet with the Poles, or we meet with the Balts, and we give them advice, like, do you tell them missile defense is a good system for you? You should be investing in that and not in, say, nuclear weapons of your own?
Oh, well, given a choice, there's no question, you know, building a missile defense system. Yes, you should. Part of your defense portfolio has got to include investments in effective theater missile defenses. Just make sure that you're testing them, that you know what you're buying, you know, and that these things actually work. You know, what we found in just another side, and the reason people thought the Patriot missile was working, it wasn't because they were lying. The system was telling them they had a hit. And what that meant was that the interceptor, which was a fragmentation warhead, exploded at the intercept point it was supposed to. It sprayed out its pellets. And then the incoming Scud didn't hit its target. There was no damage that done. And so they said, oh, we intercepted it. But they weren't doing ground damage assessments. And so there was never any. And so they assumed that because these Scud missiles, which it turns out broke up as they were re-entering the atmosphere from their short, very short outer space for part of their flight, broke up and twisted around and ended up in pieces and sort of self-destructed. Sometimes the warhead would hit something, sometimes it would land in the beach or the ocean. I suspect something similar might be going on in Ukraine, actually, where they talk about successful intercepts. Just yesterday, they said they intercepted all the missiles that were aimed at Odessa, but there was some damage because of debris. Well, debris, was it really hit? Was it, you know, so I'm a little skeptical of these claims, but still invest in it. But understand, number one, these things are never going to be 100% effective. And number two, the enemy has countermeasures. And what are the countermeasures that are coming in this kind of field? It's not just better missiles, it's drones. And this is, you know, one of the things you're really going to have to worry about 10, 20 years out is drone swarms, small things that you cannot intercept. There's no way to intercept hundreds or thousands of drones as they swarm towards you, each with a small warhead, but together they can be a very effective capability.
So this is the part on Deep State Radio where we take a little break. Joe and I are going to prepare to really geek out on all sorts of good movie references, but also talk a little bit about some other new technology, including drones, but AI.
And I might even give you a couple of solutions to this problem.
So we don't do solutions here. We just try to drive people to the bars. We get a cut of every cocktail sold after 1 o'clock in DC. But for those of you that have just tuned in and are casual listeners or have just stumbled across this on Spotify or Apple, this is the part on We're All Gonna Die Radio, where we take a break and we have to say goodbye to people that are not subscribers. Our subscribers will get to listen in for some additional content, but we encourage you to go to the Deep State Radio Network at deepstateradio.com and subscribe. For $7 a month, you can listen not only to the rest of this conversation, but you get access to the entire Deep State Radio Network of podcasts, both open and paid content. David Rothkopf, our Uber mensch, has a terrific lineup of hosts and podcasts that cover everything from inside Washington debates, foreign policy, new technology, intelligence matters. So really encourage you to go to deepstateradio.com and sign up. For those people that we have to say goodbye to, hope you have a good weekend. Hope you make it to next week. And for those paid listeners, we'll be back in just a minute.